I'd just like to correct that though I was given two sentences, the first time 64 to 69, and the second sentence of 6 years for 10. The first 5 years was for sabotage, possession of explosives, manufacturing explosives, running explosives laboratories, and possession of weapons. The second sentence of 6 years was in 98. I did not serve the full 6 years the second time because I was released on bail. But over and above the years of imprisonment, there were also years of detention, which I will explain as I go along. So I was 17 years old when I was arrested together with my school teacher, Siddiq Isaacs. He was the maths and science teacher, and he was the one who had the knowledge about bomb calorimetry and manufacturing of explosives, and he was in charge of the actual explosives laboratories which we had set up in District 6. One was in Chapel Street in District 6 and the other one in Mount Street. Of course, the landlords and the inhabitants of these houses were not aware what we were up to. But we used to go in there and manufacture this late at night and also test this stuff. The periods of detention, the longest period of detention I had was for a full year in detention without being trialed, and this was under the Internal Security Act in 1980. So my first detention was under the 90-day detention act under the then Minister of Justice, John Foster. And I was arrested in August and eventually went to trial in November and sentenced on the 1st of December 1964 to 5 years hard labor, including two of my colleagues, another student at Trafalgar High School, we were in matric, James Marsh, he got 5 years, and Abdurrahman Abrams, he was also a high school student, he was sentenced to 5 years as well. Siddiq Isaacs, the school teacher, who was 24 years old, was seen as the mastermind of the bombing campaign, the running of explosives laboratories. He received 12 years. So that was the first detention period. This was total solitary confinement. You had no access to lawyers or doctors or family members. And of course, they had the option of renewing the detention period. The 90-day detention period. Later on, the government found out that people could cope with 90-day detention, and it was increased to 180-day detention, and subsequently to indefinite detention. Of course, I didn't know that at the time, because I'm fresh off a school bench, and straight into detention, and then imprisonment. Fortunately, when we arrived on Robben Island, we discovered that there were already 1,800 prisoners on the island. The first political prisoners to be taken to Robben Island in the 20th century were in fact George Peake and Levy, Siddiq Levy. They were charged for sabotage. So that was in 1962. Before I was released from Robben Island in 1969, the then minister, Pelzer, P.C. Pelzer, had already signed a banning order 3 months before my release, and that I find odd. So I was banned under the Suppression of Communism Act, and later on reflection I discovered that Shaheed Imam Abdullah Harun had been killed on the 27th of September 1969, and I was released in December 1969. So it's obviously that the state was seeing that something was happening here in the Muslim community. The banning order expired. The banning orders are terrible things, because it's almost a 12-page document, and it prohibits you from being quoted, from working in a factory, working in an office with more than 5 workers. You are house arrested from 6 p.m. in the evening until 6 a.m. in the morning. And on weekends and public holidays, you are house arrested for 24 hours a day. You have to sign at the nearest police station at least once a week between specific times. You could not teach anybody except your own children. Of course, I was unmarried and I didn't have any children, so the only person I could teach was myself. You could not speak to more than one person, even outside your home, because that would constitute a social gathering. And you were not allowed to receive any visitors at your home. You were not allowed to enter any educational institution, private or public. Now, that means total control of you. Your mail was monitored, your telephone conversations were intercepted. This basically is what the government did at the time. I've still got these documents in my possession in case, you know, one day we need to put it on the internet to get people to understand. During the entire period of the apartheid regime, more than 3,000 people were banned. I was unfortunate enough to have been banned continuously for 11 years, and I was one of the last people to remain banned together with 9 others. The banning order expired December 1975, and then I was unemployed for a year, and a friend of mine, school inspector, Dr. Kathan, then asked me why don't I go and teach, saying that I had acquired a matric certificate whilst in prison and also did a BA and subsequently a BA honours. Because I had a prison record, I was not supposed to be allowed to teach, and this inspector said, don't worry, leave that question blank and I will sort it out. So in 1977, I went to teach in Manenberg, one of the worst ghettos in South Africa. And I taught there until the end of that year. And the principal realized that 14 other teachers and myself were busy politicizing the prisoners and asked us to leave at the end of the year. Fortunately, my second school I went to teach at in Westridge, an enormous new complex, an area housing about 250,000 people, 250,000 people. And this high school was brand new, Westridge. The principal was a person of great Christian principles. And there I could teach. So I was required to be a teacher, not a civil servant. And in 1979, the school closed on the 12th of December, on my birthday, and on the 19th of December, I received my second banning order. Obviously, they had been monitoring me, what I was doing. And as a result of that, I couldn't go back to teaching. And since that time, right up till now, 2002, I've not gone back to formal teaching in the public sector. In 1980, whilst under the banning order, I was arrested on the 2nd of May for inciting opposition to racist education in South Africa. Now, obviously, I couldn't remain idle whilst being banned, and I was unemployed. So I had lots of time on my hands to actually organize teachers and students. I was held in detention at Victor Verster Prison, together with 65 other prisoners in that area in single cells, and I was held for 243 days without being charged. On one occasion, I was punished for speaking to prisoners who had been brought down from the Transvaal, and the commanding officer of the prison had asked us not to speak to them, not even to greet them. And my Islamic principal said that if I'm not allowed to greet a fellow oppressed person, then I should not be greeting the oppressor, which I'd done up to that time. So, as a form of punishment, he confiscated all our newspapers, including the Qurans which we had. And then I took this case to court through my lawyer, and we won the case, and the state had to pay the cost of it. So this set a legal precedent that a detainee cannot be punished inside a detention center, because that definitely is not allowed in law. I was released on the 9th of December 1980, and of course the banning order continued. I was then arrested twice for breaking my banning order. The first time was because I had attended Jumu'ah, which is a social gathering, and the second time because I was outside my home after 6 p.m. in the evening. And in fact, I was at my place of employment. I then became self-employed and ran an architectural practice, and the security police had found me on the premises after 6. I was taken to court, and I dismissed my lawyer and defended myself. I was found not guilty on the charge of attending Jumu'ah, and unfortunately I was found guilty on being outside my home. I was then given a suspended sentence in that regard. Then the banning order was abrogated by new legislation. The Terrorism Act came into being because intensive pressure was being applied on the apartheid regime in the early 80s. And as a result of that, they introduced the new banning order, which now extended my period of banning. That banning order expired on the 31st of March, and they didn't renew it. So for the whole of April, I was so-called a free person. And that freedom didn't last very long, because on the 2nd of May again, I was arrested under the Terrorism Act, because 10 of our guerrillas had been intercepted at Athens Airport on their way from Libya, where they had received training, and they were on their way to Harare in order to infiltrate South Africa from there. Unfortunately, one of the guerrillas belonging to the PAC, the APLA, Azanian People's Liberation Army, had my telephone number on him. And when he was caught, they traced that telephone number to me, and I was taken into detention. Of course, P.W. Botha, the Prime Minister at the time, knew that the people who were arrested at Athens Airport belonged to Qibla, the Islamic movement. And that's when my period of detention started. We were held in detention in Cape Town, firstly at Tableview Prison, then Tableview Police Station, then Polesmoor Prison. From Polesmoor Prison, I was transported up to John Foster Square, John Foster Square to Diepkloof Prison, Diepkloof Prison to Rustenburg Prison. From Rustenburg Prison, because of attempts to escape, we were transferred to Pretoria Central. So the trial started mid-1987, and we were only sentenced on the 28th of October 1988. So we had already been in detention for almost 2.5 years. It's then that the 6-year sentence under the Terrorism Act was imposed, and I was sentenced strictly on the basis of Quranic ayah, because the Quran was seen as being a subversive document. This case was taken on appeal, but in that period, of course, the apartheid regime was negotiating with the liberation movement in order to have this transition taking place. And as a result of that, the ANC and other political organizations, but not the PAC and not Qibla, the other organizations had agreed to get the individual political prisoners to apply for indemnity. And of course, they'll be granted amnesty. My argument was that if apartheid was a crime against humanity, right, and therefore exists an international crime syndicate, and I'm the victim of this inhumane system, why should I apply for indemnity? So I refused. they didn't know what to do with us. So subsequently, they allowed us on bail. I was released on bail in 22nd of February 1991. 5,000 rand bail. If I had a passport, I had to hand it in. Report to police station twice a week. Could not act as spokesman for PAC or for Qibla, of which I'm one of the founder members of Qibla. And I was restricted to a 100-kilometer radius in Cape Town, 100 kilometers from my home. And that only came to an end on the 27th of September 1993, after the appeal was heard. The appellate division upheld the conviction, but did not send us back to jail on the grounds that we have already served more than half our sentences. So that in essence indicates exactly the nature of my period of detention, imprisonment and bannings. On Robben Island itself, it was called Devil's Island for a particular reason, because it was one of the worst prisons in the world. And firstly, the psychological tortures are numerous. The humiliation, stripping prisoners naked daily. They are strip searched. Sometimes they were even felt up with rubber gloves and soap water to see that you were not hiding goods on your body, etc. And this was just one of the forms of humiliation that many prisoners suffered. Then, of course, psychological tortures of the nature where Johnson Malumbo, who eventually became vice president in the PAC, he was serving a 20-year sentence. And on a very hot summer's day, he asked for water. So what they did, they buried him on the beachfront up to his neck in sand and then urinated in his mouth. Up till today, he has not lived down that particular humiliation. Of course, many other prisoners receive the same type of treatment. Then, as regards physical torture, hard labor, compulsory hard labor, was a form of physical torture. Also, the work was called piecework. If you did not perform and do sufficient work, they would actually punish you, including corporal punishment. But most times, they would give you a spare diet, or what they would give you meals of, so that for a couple of days you did not eat until you produced satisfactorily. I was one of the victims of corporal punishment for trying to expose conditions in prison by trying to smuggle out letters to the Amnesty International as well as the International Red Cross. Dr. Siddiq Isaacs and Bishop Stanley Makhoba, who is now the president of the PAC and is presently a member of parliament, were responsible for drawing up this document and trying to smuggle it out. The person who assisted us was a former prison warder at Polesmoor. He was in prison with us because he had tried to help us escape from Polesmoor prison. And whilst on Robben Island, he again assisted us with smuggling out this letter. Unfortunately, the warder who was to take the letters off the island to our contacts was a double agent, and he handed over all this correspondence to the security police. So we were stripped naked, tied to a contraption that looks like a horse at an incline, and then they tie your wrists and ankles, and they put a cushion on your kidneys and on your thighs, and then they whip you. The flesh splits open. This is in front of the entire prison staff, including the district surgeon of the area. And when the flesh splits open and they are finished delivering the 6 cuts, then they pour iodine into the wound on the pretext that it prevents infection. Then you get dressed and you immediately go back to work in that condition. So Bishop Stanley Makhoba, as well as Dr. Siddiq Isaacs, myself, and Arthur MacDillan were the recipients of this. Other prisoners who received corporal punishment were Johnson Malumbo for spilling a cup of mealie-meal drink onto a warder's uniform when the warder pulled him. And Indris Naidu of the ANC received corporal punishment for refusing to get into a hole of muddy water in which there were sharp stones, and they told him to take off his shoes and get into the hole under the shoes. So he was punished for disobeying a lawful command. So you can see the arbitrary nature of trying to break prisoners, the arbitrary treatment in trying to break prisoners' resistance and to humiliate them. Solitary confinement is one of the worst tortures that you can impose on any human being, because solitary confinement does not lead to torture, it is torture, because there's sensory deprivation, it's humiliation, you suffer from hallucinations, etc. And there are many cases in South Africa where the police allege that people committed suicide as a result of these pressures. But we know in most of the cases they killed the people in detention, like Ashaid, Imam Abdullah Harun, and others. Steve Biko, for example, is a classical example. The other torture was, of course, the fact that you were imprisoned on an island and you were only received one visitor every 6 months, and that visit was for half an hour. It was monitored, and you were not allowed to discuss anything except family matters. You were only allowed to write out one letter, which was censored, and you were only allowed to receive one letter every 6 months. So you can imagine the sense of isolation and literally the destruction of the bonding of the family, which was part of the psychological torture. You ask me what effect this had on my life. I can only say that because I was so young, it tempered me like fire tempers steel and made me more determined that the apartheid regime must be destroyed. Education became one of our most important means of surviving. Even though we did not have textbooks, we taught from memory. And because there were educated people in the community on Robben Island, Dr. Neville Alexander, Dr. Siddiq Isaacs and others, Bishop Stanley Mokgobo was a teacher at the time, was arrested. Siddiq Isaacs was a teacher, Dr. Neville Alexander was a teacher. So there was no shortage of people that could teach mathematics, science, law, philosophy, economics, etc. Later on, of course, when things changed, we could study these subjects formally. The other effect, of course, was that it actually tested your sincerity. And then we discovered that your sincerity, in fact, is your most indestructible weapon. Anything else can be destroyed, but not your sincerity.